Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So most liberal arts requirements include some sort of training in argumentation and in public debate. That's important if we're going to really have a public culture that argues with respect instead of just trading sound bites. And I think our political culture is very diseased right now, and we don't see examples of respectful debate.
That's the voice of author, philosopher, and legal scholar Martha Nussbaum. She speaks about education's role in building democratic political discourse in her new book, Not for Profit, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities.
We're very privileged to have Dr. Martha Nussbaum. She is the author of Not for Profit, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities. And she's a renowned professor who has published many, many books. She has been awarded the Ernest Frohn Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics in the Philosophy Department, Law School, and Divinity School at the University of Chicago. She is also the author of many books, including Hiding from Humanity, Discuss Shame and the Law. Thank you so much for joining us. We're very happy to have you on our show.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be there.
Your book is very timely. We live in a society that seems to be ravaged by war, hunger, poverty. And although we seem to have the most educated generation of ever, I would imagine, in the last, you know, we seem to know even less of how to resolve our problems. So what seems to be the problem? Why can't we seem to connect our knowledge to the needs of our world?
Well, I think, you know, of course, these problems are inherently really, really difficult. And that's one reason why I think we absolutely need disciplines like history, philosophy, and literature, as well as economics and science, to help us confront them. And so what I'm saying in the book is that it's just terribly counterproductive to cut back those disciplines, because they're a crucial part of understanding our world and training young people to be effective participants in public debates.
Well, in your book, you criticize how the focus of education has gone towards economic growth and preparing students for jobs. But what are we missing from that education? What should our education for freer culture, a practice for liberation, what would that look like?
Well, I think, you know, we've for a long time, our system of higher education has been based on the idea of liberal arts education. And although at one time that was an elitist conception, since the Second World War, the understanding has been that it's a training for democratic citizenship. And what it involves is, first of all, practice in critical thinking. So most liberal arts requirements include some sort of training in argumentation and in public debate. That's important if we're going to really have a public culture that argues with respect instead of just trading sound bites. And I think our political culture is very diseased right now, and we don't see examples of respectful debate. So we need to do that in our universities and our schools. Second, we need a kind of global understanding. We need to understand the variety of cultures in the world and religions that we deal with every day, and inside our own society, the experience and the contribution of various minority groups. Because, of course, the citizens were asked to make decisions that involve them. And so then that leads me to the third thing. We need to expand our imaginations. We come into the world able to inhabit the perspective of another person, but usually we exercise this in a very narrow sphere. We only think about the points of view inside our own family or our own immediate group. And so we need the humanities, we need history and literature to force us outside those narrow limits and get us to have some experience of understanding the perspective of other groups and positions in our society.
In the current economy of corporate neoliberalism, everything is made into a commodity, from health to education. Those who can afford it can participate. In your book, you speak to the danger of an education system that has as its first priority the goal of making money. How does a profit education undermine the principles of those ideals you just outlined?
Well, I think, the trouble is that if you just think about the education system as producing economic growth, then you think in terms of narrow and also short-term goals, and you don't even ask the question, what does the long-term health of democratic political culture require? And I think that's what's happening, particularly in state universities in this country, where they're slashing philosophy departments, language departments, and so on, because they're looking at the short term, and of course politicians have a way of doing that. They've got to go before the voters in a short time. And so they're thinking, how can I generate so and so many jobs for my state in the next 2 years before I have to run for re-election? Instead of thinking in a much more long-term way, like what would it take to build a healthy society where we really had the tools to understand one another and debate productively and respectfully about issues of the day? And I'm afraid that's a problem that's built into the whole idea of politicians making decisions about education. I mean, it's not just America. It's even worse in Europe, where almost all the education is publicly funded. Some of our system is pretty healthy, partly because private donors have a wider range of incentives, and they often care about the political culture, and they care about the humanities. And so in universities like the University of Michigan, where the public university has largely privatized, ironically, because I think it ought to be a public task to support adequate education, but I think, in fact, in practice right now, it's the private universities that are healthier simply because they don't have to depend on politicians who have narrow and short-term incentives.
In Latin America, university is seen as something you engage in to prepare to manage, the masses, to prepare to become part of an elite. It's not something that is widely accepted as the right of every student. And I think that there is a problem when we create a society that from the beginning accepts this hierarchy as natural. How do we break out of that? Because I think that's a key component of the inequity and injustice that we see worldwide.
Yeah, I think that's very important. I think there are really two separate problems. One problem that you have mentioned is the problem of hierarchy and unequal access to higher education. And that is a terrible problem. And I think we've been aware of that. And certainly every time there's a government report on higher education, that problem is front and center, as it should be. And I think that solving that problem requires beginning much further back with early intervention in preschool, I think, because really it's there that we have the best opportunity for correcting for economic inequalities. And so cutting programs like Head Start is about the worst thing we can do in those terms. But at the level of just admissions to higher education, of course we should be trying very hard to identify candidates who are deserving and give them special boost. And so the limitations on affirmative action in higher education have been very difficult to get around for people. But even so, I mean, so Texas was frustrated in one kind of attempt, and they tried another one, admitting the people with the top grade point averages in all the school systems. And I give them great credit for trying very hard to find something that would pass constitutional muster that would correct the problem. I think that's one problem, but see that there's a completely separate problem. Is what should we be equal in? Should we be equal just in a narrow range of computer science skills and skills of a highly technical nature, or should we really try to give everyone equal access to a human development that trains people for citizenship and life more generally? And this is really what my book is focused on. And I think both problems are important, but unfortunately, the second has been neglected.
And that's an important point, because if we only see the world from a mechanistic, utilitarian stand, the world is just that, things that we can manipulate, control, and transform to our whims. But if we see the world through an interconnected, relational, and codependent stand, then we have an invested interest in protecting, creating, and ensuring that goes on beyond our lifespan.
Absolutely, yeah.
And here I think your book really speaks about the role that the humanities play in creating a different way of seeing. In the current system, though, we are taught to learn to pass tests, to standardize and testing. How does this diminish our capacity for critical thinking?
Well, I think, you know, the introduction of tests, as in No Child Left Behind, it had a real motive that was serious, and that was correcting unequal access. So trying to get at these deep entrenched inequalities, people thought plausibly enough that some form of testing had to be there, and there had to be sticks as well as carrots if people were really going to care about it. But the kind of thing they chose, which is very mechanistic, which is not, doesn't involve writing essays or participating in debates, but just involves a kind of routinized mechanistic testing, discourages the other kind of thing in the classroom, because of course you don't have to teach to the test all the time, but teachers who know that their security and their salary depends on test scores will just do that. And of course they'll do that. And so they will spend more of the time in math and English class, not on the creative part and not on the critical part, but on the mechanistic part. And then other disciplines that aren't included in the test at all, like history, will just be treated as superfluous. And if we need to make cuts someplace, those will be the things that will be cut. So I think that's very unfortunate. And I think what we need to think about is how can we have forms of assessment that really will publicize and do something about inequalities in the schools, which will really correspond to genuine educational values. There are lots of people who are working on testing and lots of ways of testing that are much more labor intensive and more expensive, but they really get at real education. So I think that's what needs to happen in the schools.
When we look at the education system as a whole, as you point out in your book, it needs to be more about creating a kind of human being, that it's a full human being, not just one that knows about math and science, but one that understands the world. And Paul Freire argues that if we can understand and read our world, we can imagine a change, we can recreate it and, you know, imagine a different world. What would be your manifesto for education if you had the power to say this is what we can, what education ought to entail? What would you include? What would be the essentials that you would include in that education for students?
Well, of course, it has to be age appropriate. So my book really focuses more on higher education, but I think you can do these things at each level. And I want to say from the start that I think math and science are extremely important, and they are areas of human creativity. And in fact, they've been the basic kind of creativity involved in math and science has been shortchanged too in this push to highly applied skills that can generate short-term profit. But what I'm talking about is the contribution of the humanities and the social sciences. So let me just give my manifesto for that. And that really is the three things I've already mentioned. First of all, the ability to think critically, to lead what Socrates called the examined life, where your life is run not by authority, not by peer pressure, but by your own reflection and deliberation. Second, the ability to think as a citizen of the whole world, not just as a member of some narrow local faction or group. And that means, of course, having enough historical and economic understanding to grapple with the world and its many problems. And then finally, the cultivation, and this is where really I join hands with Freire, of the narrative imagination, trying to imagine what the world looks like from the point of view of a person whose perspective is very different from yourself, and to see that person as a full person, not just as an object of manipulation. So that would be, in a nutshell, my manifesto.
It's wonderful. And I think that one of the biggest barriers we face today is precisely that those aren't central to our education system. And when I think about the kind of struggles that we're having here in BC, when we talk about education, the focus is on how do we make teachers more accountable? So there's a discussion of merit pay. There's a discussion of standardization of testing. And there's never any real awareness of the kinds of barriers that economic, social, and cultural place on education as well. So how do we overcome those barriers that seem to be interconnected if we don't have the education grounding to even see that world from varying perspectives?
Well, I think you've already answered your own question. I think we don't. I mean, we have to do it through education. Because right now in our country, there's great de facto segregation. People don't meet people from other social backgrounds. You know, in World War II, of course, people did meet, who fought in the war, met people from other backgrounds. And I think it's very interesting. I'm teaching a course now on economic inequality, and it's very interesting that during and immediately after the Second World War was the low point of economic inequality in the U.S. There was a kind of U-shaped curve so that it was very high in the early 20th century, and then it plummeted in and after the war, and now it's way back up again. And I think it has a lot to do with seeing people from other backgrounds and knowing them as friends and as people and knowing their lives. But, you know, we just can't do that in this country given the de facto segregation that residential housing patterns put in. And busing has not really proven to be an especially effective way of doing that. So I think we have to do it through reading and through education and through study. And let's hope we build a service and travel component into our education system. So I think colleges and universities are increasingly doing that. And I think that's also very important.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Martha Nussbaum, and her book is called Not for Profit, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities. Thank you again for being with us. How can people access your book?
It's published by Princeton University Press. It's available online and through Amazon and so on. And so I hope people will take a look at it. And thank you very much, Sylvia. I really enjoyed this a lot.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That was Dr. Nussbaum and her book, Not for Profit, Why Education Needs the Humanities.
I'm going to finish today's show with a tribute to the life of Nelson Mandela. We've lost a courageous soul. I'm going to record a speech given by him in 2007 as a tribute to the elders and their responsibilities. But I would add that the responsibilities of the elders are the responsibilities that we all have in prolonging the legacy of Nelson Mandela. So I'll leave you with this talk, and so long for now.
Many of the problems we face are global in nature. These include the climate change, pandemics such as AIDS, malaria, and TB. And of course, that entirely human creation affliction, violent conflict, the structures we have to deal with, these problems are often tied down by political, economic, and geographical constraints. As institutions of government grapple often unequally with challenges they face, the efforts of a small, dedicated group of leaders working objectively and without any vested personal interest in the outcome can help resolve what often seems like intractable problems. We have the making of such a group. Some of them are here. Others, I am still to choose. Once I have had more feedback from the global community, using their collective experience, their moral courage, and their ability to rise above the parochial concerns of nation, race, and creed, they can help make our planet a more peaceful, healthy, and equitable place to live. Let us call them global elders, not because of their age, but because of their individual and collective wisdom. This group derives its strength not from political, economic, or military power, but from the independence and integrity of those who are here. They do not have careers to build, elections to win, constituencies to please. They can talk to anyone they please and are free to follow paths they deem right, even if hugely unpopular. It is now several years since Richard Branson and Peter Gabriel came to me with their idea of the elders. Since then, I have watched the concept grow, gain structure and strength, and become a real, viable, and pragmatic initiative. I believe that with their experience and their energies and their profound commitment to building a better world, the elders can become a fiercely independent and robust force for good, tackling complex and intractable issues, especially those that are not popular. However, I know that this group will not become arbitrary and arrogant, and that it will seek advice from expert organizations and work cooperatively with them. What's more, they will not take the easy, short-term route, but support a long-term, sustainable approaches that address the root cause of the problems they tackle. They are, I know, committed to working with local and indigenous knowledge, to listening and bringing together antagonists and protagonists, to working with anyone who is motivated to resolve a problem. They can help foster and introduce innovative ideas and little-known solutions to connect those who have real practical needs with those who have something to give. Through their friends in business, they can mobilize up-to-date technology and raise not only awareness of forgotten issues, but also help locate the resources to address them. But whatever techniques they use, I believe that in the end, it is kindness and generous accommodation that are the catalyst for real change. I know these esteemed friends of mine are capable of doing all these things, and I expect that if my friend, the Archbishop, has anything to do with it, they will insist on assuming the essential interdependence of all humankind. We call this the spirit of Ubuntu, that profound African sense that we are human only through the humanity of other human beings. I am confident that the elders can become a real role model, leading, guiding, and supporting all sorts of initiatives, both their own and those of many others. The elders can speak freely and boldly, working both publicly and behind the scenes on whatever actions need to be taken. They will reach out to those who most need their help. It is those who have the least and who therefore suffer the most. It is those who are rarely heard. This group of elders can represent them and make sure they are not ignored. I am also certain that they will support courage where there is fear, foster agreement where there is conflict, and inspire hope where there is despair. This initiative cannot have come at a more appropriate time. It brings together an extraordinary collection of people with the skills and resources to undertake what we know is an enormous task. I am proud to be here at this launch of what is known as the Global Elders. As I have said before, I am trying to take my retirement seriously, and I will unfortunately not be able to participate in the really exciting part of their work, analyzing problems, seeking solutions, searching out partners. But I wish them well and hope they succeed in bringing light to some of the darkness that afflict our world, and new energy to areas where others have become weary because of the endless conflict. I thank you.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.